This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
I'm going to pick up here. I do want to mention one thing. I just got to thinking about this, but I think we glossed over it a little. So I just want to mention one thing, just so we get it in. In these series and this topic that we've been talking about, going back quite into history, and there's a lot there. I'll grant, it's a lot. But when we were talking about going from the writings, the biblical writings, and then we went to the early translations, well, the texts, how many texts there are, that they find the manuscripts and the earliest translations. So one thing I didn't mention that I want to be clear about it is a step in this process, and it's frankly something that people ask about a lot. And this is the idea of the cannon. This is a word they often use. And what does that mean? Well, a cannon, of course, is a really large gun. But it's but it's also something else. These words sometimes have more than one meaning. Another thing a cannon can mean is like a collection. In fact, in the literary world and when it comes to writings and everything, sometimes people talk about a certain collection. Like, for example, someone might say, talk about the canon of Shakespeare, Shakespeare's canon. What they mean is all the collection of writings that he did, all the things he wrote. And some things he wrote would belong to that collection, but then some things wouldn't belong to it, like things he didn't write. So it comes from a Greek word that has to do with measuring, like something, whether something makes the measures up or belongs. And so that's what they use to talk about the canon of Scripture. What they mean is, okay, you have many texts, many books, and obviously people make translations from those. But when it comes to the collection of the books, the ones that are bound together, this is the idea that those belong and no others belong. That's the idea. So sometimes people ask about that, because that's part of the history too. They come from a span of time, crossing over a lot of centuries, you know, different writers. And as some people might know, in the early days of the church, some people started to write other books intended to sort of look like the books that were so popular and carried so much weight. So there would be circulating at some point books like a Gospel of Peter and a Gospel of Mary Magdalene. And the most famous of these is the Gospel of Thomas. And so some people wonder, hey, wait a minute now. Why didn't we get those in there? And there's good reasons why. And one of those reasons is that the early church pretty well knew what was what. They already were copying, circulating, and binding these things together. And they knew that they were fraudulent things. They knew that they were groups that didn't really represent the Christian truth, the Christian gospel, but they still had a veneer. So they were what we call Gnostics. I mean, Paul writes against these people. And they borrow terminology that sounds pretty Christian. But their belief system is not the biblical belief system, even though they use some of the terms. And so Paul warns people about these Gnostics. And so they wrote some of these books. And really, the biggest thing that would indicate to you why something like the famous Gospel of Thomas wouldn't have belonged, I would simply tell you, go, find, and read it. It'll become pretty apparent that this is not like anything I've read in the Bible. Very different sounding stuff. So it became important to say, this is authoritative. This really came from the apostle that we think it came from, whereas this over here did not. And they pretty well knew. They didn't have to get it together, throw darts at a board. I mean, they didn't roll dice. It wasn't just willy-nilly. And it also wasn't some nefarious conspiracy where someone angled to get some books in for some, you know, I don't know, selfish reason or something, whatever you might come up with why. So I wanted to mention that since I had sort of left that out. And I want to make sure we know that this is part of the process. This is part of the preservation and the history of the text that the church was there to say, these four Gospels we know are authentic and good, but this newcomer that came along, no sir, they were wise. I mean, they had taken what the apostles said to heart, the warnings to look out for false teachers with false Gospels, and you know, you've got to be wise. So they did so. So now that we got that in, we were talking about a lot of translations. We all read a translation, don't we? More than one, although usually they're all English ones for most of us in here, I think. But we talked about a lot of translations that were really important, but we didn't get to the English translation. So I want to start talking about the English translations, the Bible in your language, in my language. So I'm going to show you some nice history here that tells us, what about these Bibles we're carrying, we're reading from, and all the others? What about this language that we, all of us in here, to some degree or another, try our best to speak on a regular basis with moderating success? You know, so the Bible in English is what I wanted to say. And I think I won't even get to the most modern ones, which I want to, next time I want to show you comparisons of why the different ones that we now have. Like some of you might carry an NIV, and the person next to you has got the NASB, and the other person's got the ESV, and this guy over here's got the Message, and someone else is carrying the art, whatever. And what are the differences, and why do those exist? And we will get to that, because there are reasons for why those were all done with their whatever theories behind them each. We did this already, this idea of translation. So let's move on to the English translations. So here we are with English, the Bible in English. That's a cool looking old page from one of those old ones right there with that font that's hard to read from way back in the early days of printing.
Where King James?
That one is actually not. I don't think,
English,
but
is it?
That says 1571. I'm going to show you more. Well, it won't be like a museum session or anything. By the way, they had a cool thing came through a few years ago where, what was that called? The English Bible. It was an exhibit. Anybody see that? Mm-hmm. Wasn't that something? They had a lot of old manuscripts there. The real ones, you know?
Museum.
Yeah, the Museum of the Bible. Or no, is there a permanent part of that that's there? Or?
It's in Washington.
It's in Washington.
Well, they...
We had it.
Okay, good. Yeah. So I enjoyed. I remember going through it all and.
Print you off the page of the Psalms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they would show you that. So wherever Christianity went, you know, they were eager to get the Bible in the people's language. We still are. We're still trying to do that. But it's always been like that. So along comes English, and along comes the need for English Bibles. Now, English didn't always exist like it does now. They sounded different, still qualified as English. So I want to show you medieval times in England and just where this sort of starts. Yeah, it goes back a ways. Look at that. The Middle Ages, they were speaking something that, well, I guess it sort of qualifies as English. We wouldn't understand much of it at all if we heard someone walk in speaking it today. But they started to translate the Bible into Anglo-Saxon language. You ever heard of that? Anglo-Saxon. That's some old, old English, sort of like the great-grandpappy of English is Anglo-Saxon. So, you know, over there in what we now call England, just a bunch of tribal people once upon a time, light-skinned, you know, light-skinned, Caucasian-looking people, but basically just tribes. Just living like tribal people live, worshiping this or that gods of all different kinds, worshiping nature, heaven, whatever. That's how they lived before Christianity came to them. But eventually, you know, and the Roman Empire colonized it, and so they turned it into their own province, Britannia. And then it's got a whole history. But eventually these different Germanic kind of groups, you got your Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes and the Celts and all these kind of people, and they begin to Christianity becomes a spreading and growing religion among them. But the Latin Bible is the Bible. But there were poets. There were some of them that would start to put it into their own language at the time. Anglo-Saxon, I don't know if anyone reads it now, but you know, it was a study. In fact, the great, Tolkien, the writer, you know, Lord of the Rings? Tolkien, I think his specialty at Oxford was he was professor of Anglo-Saxon. I wonder wherever you might have gone taking some college classes, was there a professor of Anglo-Saxon anywhere around? You ever? I'm going to sign up for Intro to Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah.
Because French sounded too hard. Well, they studied it then, at least up until the 20th century. I don't know if they're still doing it, but trying to learn it. In fact, if you ever watch The Lord of the Rings, you see some of the people in it speak a funny language, like the elves. Well, he invented those languages. Tolkien kind of made them up, but he based it on Anglo-Saxon. That's kind of what it sounds like, honestly. When they're talking, it has echoes of the old Anglo-Saxon. That's kind of what he knew. So,
I read a story one time about a young lady who was going to work her way around the world, and she started in English, in England, because she thought she spoke the language.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of different words.
Yeah. Even today, English, though it's global, that doesn't mean it's exactly the same everywhere. It's still English, but you might, you know, I was listening to... there's this movie now, speaking of the Lord of the Rings, the guy that made those movies has made a different thing. It's not related to that at all. But he's made this documentary now. They Shall Not Grow Old, I think that's what he called it. And he was given footage from the Imperial War Museum, rare footage, maybe unseen footage, from World War I. Lots of footage. And then they put it through this incredible process now that they have with the digitized, to slow it down slightly, because, you know, old black and white stuff moves too fast. You ever watch it? Everyone's going around too fast. They slow it just enough to make it look real, like it would now. And the color job is amazing. And you watch it now, and it's unbelievable. It's shocking how real it looks. It's like, wow, I'm standing here in the trenches of World War I. It's never looked so real as they made it look. But my point to say that is, throughout, they've got a big cast of these very old Englishmen from whenever they recorded them who had memories of it, and they play all of this. And just to your point, you know, I'm listening to it, and it's so funny to me. I got such a kick out of listening to these old guys from whenever they were recorded doing this, but they lived during that time. But they're all like, they're from all around England, and some of them are Welsh, and they're this and that, and a couple of Scotsmen, and they've got all this array of accents from around. But they use all these terms. I don't even know what they're saying sometimes. These colloquial words. This shows you that it's different. Well, when you translate the Bible or anything, you sometimes may use some of those words that you figure the people know, but then someone else even who's an English speaker may not know it. Anglo-Saxon, if you were to get your hands on some of the old Anglo-Saxon Bible texts, I mean, it wouldn't do anything for you, except it would be an interesting artifact. But they did some of this. They only were using the Latin, and only parts of it would get translated. So you have here the great scholar and writer Bede, sometimes called St. Bede or the Venerable Bede, as I learned him in school. And he wrote a lot, and one of the things he did was translate some of the Gospels, I mean, specifically the Gospel of John, into Anglo-Saxon. So not a lot of it there. And then Alfred the Great tried to do some of the Old Testament. But this is the earliest stuff going on in England, and really not a lot then until you get to the next guy, whose name you definitely know, because his name is John Wycliffe. So I got a little something to show you here with Wycliffe. Look at how long it takes, though. Now he's born in 1330. So now we're this far up, and again, there's no Bible being handed out or used across England where the people can read in their language. So it's still just the Latin, but some people notice this. So here's Wycliffe, and Wycliffe thought this was problematic. He thought a lot of things were problematic, as a matter of fact. He was, some people say, he was a He was a medieval Protestant, some people call him, because they say he, early on, he was pointing out a lot of problems that a couple hundred years down the road would become the basis for the Reformation. But he could see it early on. He thought there's a lot that needs to be changed. There's a lot that needs reforming in the church of his time. And so he starts to do some translating, he and some other people, because he decided one of the things that we need as I'm serving the people is I'd like them to read and understand. Well, the church is doing nothing about this, so I'll take matters into my own hands. So he did some of that. He and a few other people, he kind of got some people to collaborate, to help do some of the work. But you know, he just was using the Latin that he had. He's just translating from Latin into the English of his time, Middle English, they would have called it. But the people were so hungry for it that what they did would get copied and copied and copied. And people want it, you know. People valued it a lot. So it got copied and it became a very, very widespread. And, of course, once they got closer to the Reformation, a little ways down the road after his death, they decided to go ahead and officially condemn him as a heretic. So, you know. How dare he? And so he was the inspiration for a lot of people who came later. In fact, during Luther's big trial, when they come to him and he's on trial, and they give him the writings of Wycliffe and say, "Do you agree with this man's writings?" And you know, to Luther's credit, because he was nothing if not pretty bold, he read them all that night. He said, "I'll get back to you tomorrow and tell you what I think." He read them all, and he came back the next day and said, "Oh yeah, this guy was onto something." See, he knew he had been condemned as a heretic. So he's basically, you know, he's just owning it. Yeah, you might have called him a heretic, but I read what he wrote, and yeah, he's pretty much right. All of his criticisms. And so that's Wycliffe, an important pivotal figure for being one of the first to really, he and his collaborators, to publish a full English Bible. You know, even though it's not like Wycliffe was the greatest Greek or Hebrew scholar. He really wasn't necessarily. And he was using the Latin Bible, not the original stuff. But he just thought, look, I'm going to get something into the hands of people. And for what it was worth, it did a lot of good. You know, did a whole lot of good. But then some times changed. So I got to tell you, the next guy up here. Yes, sir. Question.
Detrimental is it to the church, to non-believers, for us to do something as foolish as digging up bones of a dead dude to burn them?
Right.
I mean, seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, they decided that was the plan there, the Council of Constance, I think it was. This is that council where they condemned. I always thought, boy, they showed him, didn't they? I mean,
yeah.
Give me a break. It's just so symbolic. Yeah, big deal. You're going to go to the trouble to dig up his bones just for the sake, the symbolism of it, I guess. Just, what, are you going to make an example of his bones? Yeah. Watch out. Your bones are next.
It's so silly. I mean, we go through all the, we tell people, you know, they're not here anymore, they're gone, they're whole, they're with the Lord, and then they dig up his bones and they burn them as a symbol. Like, for what?
Yeah, some people say they're trying to they scatter the ashes in the different rivers. They're trying to make it real hard for him on the resurrection. Ooh, sounds like a check. Yeah, I wonder if God would look down and say, "Challenge accepted."
Even then, there are even people today that don't understand the death resurrection concept. There are a lot of other religions that the burial of the body is extremely important to them. They get upset if somebody takes the body and burns it, because that has to them connotation of what happens to the spirit. And so back then they may have had that same those different religions today have as a concept, came from somewhere.
In the mildest sense, a big insult to your family that your remains were desecrated, but to what you're saying, in a more extreme sense, a person could think somehow, I don't know, this jeopardizes his soul or has some negative or adverse effect on him in the next life.
Want to make sure the body gets buried.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, their spirit does not go to any place but wanders the earth.
Right. That has been a belief, you're right, that some people have had. Certainly other religions have it in some cases. But you're right, even in the West, there has sometimes been that idea like, you're right, without proper burial, you're restless. You weren't properly laid to rest. So somehow we botched your exit and transition, you know, by what we did. Yeah, that may be kind of rooted in a Semitic thing. Certainly we don't see anything from the Hebrew Bible, right? That seems to think that. I mean, dead bodies are unclean, but
I think it would have something to do with them worrying about if their soul was going to make it to heaven if they desecrated
right.
His grave and scattered his
yeah, ashes. And so the church.
People have trouble with cremation now.
Uh huh.
Oh yeah. Eastern Orthodox do not do cremation.
Right.
Well, I had shared with my stepsister about us being cremated, and she was like, and she's a believer, and she was like, well, then what about when Jesus comes? And I'm thinking, well, if you've been dead for how many years, what do you think's going to be there?
Yeah, he's going to need everyone to be like mummified nicely to make it work.
I read something on the death of Lazarus, you know, he'd been in the tomb for 4 days, and somewhere I read that there was a belief back then among the Jews, kind of in general, that the spirit kind of hung around in the vicinity for 3-4 days after the person died before it went.
Yeah. I have encountered people, though, to your point, and they do seem like, and I don't know, I think there is a difference between thinking, oh no, you know, like you should be worried or panic that your ashes can't be reconstructed. I think there's a difference in that concern and a different concern that I've heard from some people who think cremation isn't the best, and that what they'll think is that somehow that even in a, this is a debatable thing, I think it's a kind of a subject that'd be worth, I don't know, thinking about, but they'll say, you know, the Christian understanding, though, of the body isn't that the body is trash, or we don't look down on the physical body or curse it the way that some religions, like dualist religions, do, like the flesh is evil. We still honor the body. It's still part of who you have been, and God gave it to you and made it. That's different, obviously. I guess it would be interesting to read more about this symbolic act that they did to Wycliffe, everything they meant by that, but certainly it was a visual sign to the masses that this guy's bad, he's a heretic, and we can't kill him because he went and died already before this council. But so the next best thing we can do is destroy his remains.
It sounds like that they burned because they just
buried the bones. Mm-hmm. Interesting. You're talking about like, yeah. I don't know if they do that. They do it for everybody. Like, I think some of them probably with ancestor worship feel like their ancestors, they're still, and they do leave food for statues and things like that in certain Buddhisms. Well, it's like we've often said, This is worldview, isn't it?
Yeah.
And this is all part of how they're raised, and they beliefs matter. I mean, they affect how you see these things, and then they affect what you do. So those people are acting in accordance with what they are convinced how what is the case.
Sort of a convenient little way to get
them. You know, yeah, and I think and by the way, I should mention since we're I think I said in my description of Wycliffe here, yeah, I mentioned did I mention him by name? Yeah, there it is. This guy Jan Hus, right? John Hus. You only see his name. It's part of it's trailing off there. He is the Czech reformer from Prague, and he was very influenced and impressed by Wycliffe, what Wycliffe did, and he was a priest, and he started to have reforms there among the Czech people, and he translated the Bible into their language. Well, that same council that decided to dig up Wycliffe's bones and burn them, they invited Hus, who was still alive now, to come to the council to give his concerns, because as a priest he has a lot of concerns about ways the church should reform. And it so happens he had also been a translator, like Wycliffe. He very much liked Wycliffe, kind of the Wycliffe of the Czech people. Well, they make it sound as though we're inviting you to the council to express these views and we can debate them and whatever. And they say he'll have safe conduct and all that. And frankly, this is one of the more ugly and despicable chapters of what the church was capable of. And this is all coming just before, not too long before the Reformation is going to explode. And, you know, part of why it happened. Things like this helped lead to the Reformation. I mean, you talk about egregious. When Hus got there, they immediately imprisoned him. Left him in a cell for a long time while they conducted their other business. These councils would go on for weeks and weeks, dealing with all the stuff. Left him to molder in a cell. Then finally decide they're going to get around to him. Bring him out. And does he get to share all of his opinions? And no. It basically was, recant all the heretical things you've been saying, or else. That was his choice. So he would not do that. He didn't think he was wrong for any of the things he'd said. And Hus was executed. So, yeah, this is the kind of thing that the Church of the Middle Ages had sometimes done that caused. What do you think everyone else did when they heard it? When they see the Church do this to one of their brightest scholars and priests who are trying to reform, and they see them treat him that way, you know, that's not good for the church's reputation. So then when the Reformation breaks out, a lot of Czech people were ready to sign up. They were still mad. And in Prague, you know, Hus's statue is still there. I had a guy in a class years ago who was born and raised, he's a Czech, he was born and raised around there. And he was telling me that, oh yeah, he said over there and among my people, this guy's a big time hero of history, you know. So he was a translator in his own right. But I gotta get to Tyndale now, my next guy up. So Tyndale is extremely important as anyone, not just in English Bible history, but really in the history of the English language. Some people think, and there may be something to it, that besides Shakespeare, William Tyndale, as far as single individuals, had more influence on the shaping of the English language that we now speak than anybody, because it was during a time when English was really coming into its own. I mean, English, once upon a time, Old English was like, and Middle English was considered a kind of a backwater European language that a few people spoke over on that island. It was not significant. It was not considered an important language. But after the Elizabethan period, English was one of the crowning languages. It was a great language, and of course, in the centuries that followed, up into our own time, English is now one of the leading global languages, maybe the global language, maybe the number one language. So who's responsible for that? Well, that flowering of the language, that when it really came into its own, was you know, people like Shakespeare had something to do with it, but so did Tyndale. Now, how did Tyndale? Well, it's because of the lineage of his influence in the English Bibles, culminating in the King James, which we won't get to today. We'll do that with the modern translations next time. I know you're saying, that's not modern, but we'll start there and then move to the modern. But Tyndale is the guy. This guy was, you know, different from Wycliffe because he is a brilliant scholar and he has the linguistic gift. You know, not everybody's good at that, right? I mean, are you? I don't know. Maybe you are. But if you are, you might know it, and if you're not, you definitely know it. Not linguistically inclined. But some people are. You might know people like that. They can learn a language. How do they do that? And they're just good at that sort of thing. And this was Tyndale. He just was linguistically gifted. And he was influenced by the Reformation ideas. Now, he lives in a different time, see? He lives after the Reformation has broken out and started to change the landscape. It's a fresh movement. It's a thing that's happened. So he lives in that time. Not only that, he lives after some of the events in what they call the Renaissance, of course, where a lot of good texts have come about, and they have Greek texts. He has access to good Greek and Hebrew texts, and Wycliffe didn't have that. So he's got a lot going for him in these ways. And he reads what Luther wrote, and he reads what Erasmus has written, and all these people, and he's saying, man, there's something to this. And there are little movements at Oxford and then at Cambridge, and he's sort of involved in those. So he's reform-minded. Then he goes out to be a minister, and he's sort of disgusted because why isn't there even an English Bible here? We've got Europe's having this great period of Reformation, and all these things are happening. And frankly, he's pretty much on board with their ideas. And what are we doing over here? So he thinks we need a good quality English Bible from these good Greek and Hebrew texts. And I kind of have the training and ability. I think I could do it. But nobody wants him to do it. Like, church authorities don't want him to do it. And he can't find permission. He tries to get permission. Hey, why don't we commission this? Let me do this. No. So the only way he can do it is he's got to leave England. He has no permission there. He will not have the freedom. In fact, he could get in trouble. So he goes over to where there is freedom to do this, which is parts of Europe where the Reformation is. So he goes to Germany, probably met Luther. We don't have a record of it. He goes to the Swiss cities where the Calvinists are, and they're free. So he's able to do his work. So Tyndale gets to work. And guess what else he has? This newfangled thing called the printing press. That's pretty cool. All Wycliffe's translations that got copied and copied, all of that stuff was hand copy. So there's no print yet. So he has all this. It's kind of like, he must have felt like I was born for such a time as this, you know, to do this work. And he really felt that way. And by the way, he also wrote a lot of other stuff that was Reformation stuff. I mean, like, he had opinions on all those kind of things, which got him not too well liked by the authorities. And they ended up coming to look for him. So he's sort of on the run, and he's got this guy, Miles Coverdale, helping him out. And he's translating, and he's running off copies from the print as it happens, and he's smuggling them into England. And there's this game going on the ports of England where, you know, Sir Thomas More and these kind of authorities are trying to find the smuggled Bibles of Tyndale and destroy them. And so, it's like the war on Bibles. And meanwhile, the Tyndale cartel is, you know, got some Bible mules. I'm sorry, enough drug references. But so he's doing that, and then but they finally find an Englishman who finds him and befriends him. Because, see, there was a safe part of the Netherlands he was staying in where he couldn't be arrested. But if you got him out of that area, he could be arrested. And this friend, he was an Englishman who betrayed him. He became his friend, earned his trust, and then betrayed him to the authorities. So Tyndale winds up in a prison where he languishes for a long period. Finally, he gets a brief kangaroo trial, you know, basically it's a joke. And then under the auspices of the Netherlands, basically being pushed by the Roman Catholic authorities, he is strangled to death, executed by strangling to death, and then burned. Right? They put him up to a pole, build the wood under him, put the wire around his neck, then they They strangle him with it, and then they light him up. You know, that's what happens to him. Now, here's the irony of this, though. By the time that's happening, when he's finally there, when he's finally getting to the point of being executed, things are changing in England. Now, there's a tradition says that Tyndale's dying words were, "Lord, open the eyes of the King of England." That's what they say that he said. I think Fox's Book of Martyrs says that, and some others. And the King of England, of course, was Henry, you know, the big fella, the Eighth. You know, that character you like to read about so much. Him with his wives and that whole... But that whole soap opera caused him to drag England into the Reformation. I say drag. A lot of them wanted to, but Henry brought the Reformation to England. He basically stumbled into it. He was no Martin Luther. In fact, early in his career, he wrote against Martin Luther. Henry, he was like, the Catholic Church gave him the title of, you know, defender of the faith, fidei defensor, whatever. And isn't he great? Isn't England on our side? Good, staunch Roman Catholic. Until he had the run-in with trying to get the annulment and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then he decided, I'm kind of tired of the church, really. Why don't we make our own? Got Parliament to pass it, making the king the head of the church. And then he could look over to the Pope and go, ha ha, I'm the Pope over here. You're not the boss of me anymore. So Henry was no great saint, but one way or the other, England broke ties with Rome. Then suddenly, guess what? It becomes a little more friendly to the idea of it. Henry decides, you know what? We want an English translation. Oh, now you want one. Your best translator had to leave and wound up getting himself executed just recently here. But now you want English translations. Well, luckily they had Tyndale's work, and luckily they had Coverdale, his assistant, to kind of help refine and finish it out and get some copies made. So what happens is Tyndale sparks a movement. So I kind of want to show you a thing. This will be my last slide here for today. You really can look at two great periods of English Bibles. Periods where lots of English Bibles were done, new Bibles. And the first period is the one we've been talking about, the 16th century. And the second one is the 20th century. Are the two centuries where, and they, you know, trails off a little bit into the ones before or after, but mostly those two centuries where you had a lot of Bible translating going on and lots of new ones coming out. The first one that we've just been talking about is basically kick-started because of the Reformation and because of Tyndale's work. The second one we'll talk about next week when we get down to the Bibles we read and how they came about. But I want to tell you a little bit about some of these other Bibles that came after, which for that, I'm going to read something you don't have, but it's because I wanted, somebody did a good job here, I'll have to squint on my own little tablet here, of doing this, telling us about them. I learned about these a long time ago, but some of these were featured in that Bible exhibit. But after this, so you have the Coverdale Bible. Look at all those years. So this, obviously, Tyndale has been killed, but most of these Bibles are basically revisions on Tyndale's work. So the Coverdale Bible, just reading here, the Bible of Miles Coverdale, who was Tyndale's assistant. He did not translate directly from Greek and Hebrew, but he used, you know, Tyndale had done that work, but he also consulted Luther's German translation, and he helped to edit and complete and put the finishing touches on that Bible. Henry VIII had already permitted Coverdale's Bible to be printed when Tyndale uttered his dying words. The most innovative thing in this Tyndale Bible is that it placed the Apocrypha, you know, it's those books we mentioned, the Roman Catholics still have in their Bible, at the end of the Old Testament, which now almost all Bibles that have it at the end. You have this thing called the Matthew's Bible, which comes along, and it was because the guy who did it used a pseudonym, you know, that's a fake name, called himself Thomas Matthew. He was actually a scholar, though, named John Rogers. His pen name was Thomas Matthew, but he was a pretty good scholar, and he took Coverdale's work and he took Tyndale's work and he did his own thing. Rogers added about 2,000 notes. Some of the notes he added were controversial, though. You know, like you have a Bible and you have the Bible text and then you have a bunch of notes. Like, you know, you have a study Bible, has notes all over, right? So that was a new thing, people starting to have notes in their Bible. So, I mean, like Bibles with footnotes and all that. So this Matthew's Bible had these footnotes, this guy John Rogers did, but some of them were kind of controversial. So some people referred to this Bible as, quote, the wife beater's Bible. And the reason is because, you're going to like this, there was a marginal note in 1 Peter 3:7 where Rogers had put this little gem of a note. He said, quote, if the wife be not obedient and helpful unto her husband, he endeavoreth to beat the fear of God into her. Did I hear? Okay, who amened that? Yeah. Jeremy's wondering, where do I get that Bible? That sounds like a great... I'd really love to have some devotionals out of that Bible. You know, for devotionals for couples. Get yours today for Valentine's Day. Behold, love thy wife, but if she giveth thee lip, let her feel the back of thy hand. I'm just kidding. Yes. So that was the Matthew's Bible. And then briefly, I'll just tell you a little bit about these couple of these other ones. So the Great Bible sounds really great. Sounds kind of arrogant, right? It was only called the Great Bible because they meant great like it was big. Because what happened is these Bibles had Henry VIII's permission to be printed, but he decided, I want a Bible in every church. I want like an official Bible in every church, like a decorative Bible. I want one, a pulpit Bible. Well, it needs to be big so it can be read. It needs to be big and ornate and all this. But most of those other Bibles were small. So they commissioned this Bible, again, mostly using Coverdale. So again, it's just another revision of Tyndale's work. And they did this Bible, which was so big they called it the Great Bible just because of its size. And by the way, they would chain it to the pulpits, but not because we don't want the people to be able to read it. In this case, it was because someone's going to steal it. It's a nice Bible. Some fool will take off with it. So that's how they did it. So then the next one up here, I was going to mention to you about this Geneva Bible. This is a pretty cool story here. So remember, Geneva's the Swiss town where all the Calvinists are. Calvin is there, and it's kind of like this little Protestant haven. So you know what happens, though. Henry dies, right? After his long and goofy career, he dies. And then there's something weird happens. He's got this son who's kind of sickly. And this Edward, and he lasts for, I don't know how long, not long. And then it's like, okay, we're out of males. What shall we do? Well, time to see how a queen can do. That they hadn't done that one before. And guess who's the oldest daughter? Mary! And guess who her parents are? The Spanish king and queen. And guess what they are? Hardcore Roman Catholic. So she's hardcore Roman Catholic. So she says, there's a new sheriff in town, and all this Protestant stuff is nonsense, and we're going back to Rome. And so she starts just killing the Protestants, and a bunch of them have to leave. That's why she earned that really happy nickname of hers, right?
Bloody Mary.
Bloody Mary! It's not just a drink, people. So she was hazardous to the health of the Protestants. So a bunch of the Protestants left, and what they did was, a bunch of them went to Geneva, and while they're in Geneva, a lot of them worked on another Bible. And this became the Geneva Bible. And some cool things about the Geneva Bible. Now, they had good... It was the first English Bible translated by committee. You know, Tyndale had been one man, but this was a full committee. And most modern translations are committee-based, but this was one. It had notes in it that were very much Reformed, because they're sitting there under the teaching of Calvin all these years. So, naturally, the Geneva Bible is very Calvinistic. It was the first Bible with verse divisions. Sometimes you forget. You know, the Bible you read has all those verses, you know, verse 5, verse 6. That's not original. That stuff's added. It was just text. So those were added for reference purposes. And this was the first Bible to do that. It was probably the Bible that the pilgrims took with them when they left and came to America. Probably had the Geneva Bible, almost surely. And it was the first Bible to use italics for certain words. You know, good old print italics. They still didn't do the red letter stuff just yet. So, then these other ones, the Bishop's Bible, anyway, the Douay Rheims is a Catholic Bible in English, because there were still English Catholics and they wanted their own Bible. They didn't want all those Calvinistic notes in there. But guess what they did, which is kind of silly. Even though they had good Greek and Hebrew manuscripts, the Catholic, the English-speaking Catholics with, for their Bible, they still just used the Latin to translate from. It's like, so hung up on the Latin. Because see, the church officially said to the Council of Trent, the Roman Catholic Church, that the Latin was the only Bible you should ever use. So if you're going to do a translation, you better use the Latin. It wasn't until Vatican II that they finally said,